The closest I have ever been to a black bear was very, very close. I was a reporter in Alaska, and this cub, just about the size of a house cat, had been orphaned, rescued, and brought to a nearby sanctuary. And it was curious about my microphone. It was curious about me, too, clinging to my leg for a while and then just kind of rolling off to the side playfully. This was an extremely controlled situation, but it was still very uncomfortable and a little terrifying. In the wild, being near a cub is extremely dangerous, usually because the mother is nearby and not altogether pleased to see you near her offspring. Obviously, it is also dangerous to be near a fully grown black bear. But it feels like more and more people in northern Michigan are crossing paths with bears. So the question arises, how do we coexist with them? We will talk a little about that this week on the Up North Lowdown from Interlochen Public Radio. Hey, I'm Ed Ronco. Thanks for joining us. We will also get an update on that stink bug mystery in Frankfurt we told you about last week. But first, a quick visit to Sheboygan. Back in September, the Sheboygan Tissue Depot on this old historic factory site at the edge of the city's downtown went up in flames. Owen Goslin, the executive director of the Sheboygan Opera House, described the scene to IPR as he looked down the street from just outside his office.
We're 3/4 of a mile north of the fire. As I look downtown, I can see a huge plume of gray smoke coming from the site, and I've never seen a fire this big in town before.
So that was September. The site has been in disrepair since then. But this week, developers announced plans for a $50 million project, which could transform the site into housing, businesses, and more. Here's IPR's Michael Livingston.
If you've ever driven north into Sheboygan's downtown, you've probably passed the Tissue Depot, or at least what's left of it. While the facility was owned by Procter & Gamble until 1990, it was one of the largest employers in the region. But last summer, one of its warehouses burned down. Before that, the roof caved in on a different part of the facility. Local developer Bob Pulte says he's ready to buy the whole thing and build something new that Sheboygan can be proud of.
Housing, some new retail, a hotel, a special events center. So it's a multi-use development we're hoping to bring jobs and housing to Sheboygan.
Pulte comes from the national developer Pulte Homes, but says this project is under his own company, RP Investments. But developers have many hurdles ahead, including getting local approval, grants to fund construction, and fixing the site's hydroelectric dam.
Michael Livingston with that story. Local economic development officials say the project could take years to complete, but at least one neighbor says he has been waiting a while for an idea like this to come along. Jim Conboy has lived across the street from the building since 1972.
There's some siding and some brick facade coming off. That's just on the site I can see. From the other side of the river, I've been told there's even trees growing out of part of the building. You know, it's been a problem for a long time.
There's a lot more to know about this project. What exactly will it look like after it goes through governmental approvals? How will other neighbors feel about it? And will tenants, both residential and commercial, be excited to move in? We will be watching, and we will certainly keep you updated. Now to Frankfurt and the mysterious stink bugs. If you remember last week, we went with IPR's Cheryl Bartz on a walk along the Lake Michigan beach there when she made an alarming discovery. She did a little digging and has this update.
In case you missed it, in late May, I found a huge row of bright green bugs on Frankfurt Beach, piled a few inches high, a couple of feet wide, as far as I could see in both directions. They were stink bugs, but were they the Michigan green stink bug, or were they the exotic southern green stink bug? And how did they wind up dead on Frankfurt Beach? The first mystery was solved by Nate Walton, extension agent. I took him a large jar of gross green bugs, and he identified them as our common green stink bug. The second mystery was, why so many? Juliana Wilson, tree fruit entomologist with MSU, had an explanation. Adult stink bugs are known to congregate. She said this looked like a group that was picked up and blown into Lake Michigan. Why were they dead? That's easy. They don't swim. They're built for moving around in vegetation. Where did they come from? Did an east wind pick them up in a Michigan orchard and blow them into the lake? Or did they blow in from Wisconsin or points west? After several fruitless phone calls, I consulted the Weather Underground online. I could tell you that the data showed that during the 2 days before I encountered the bugs, Algoma, Wisconsin, right across the lake from Frankfort, had winds out of the west with gusts up to 52 miles an hour. That's consistent with my hypothesis that these bugs originated in Wisconsin. I could tell you that, but that's way too unscientific. There's still a possibility that a sudden gust from Michigan carried our own stink bugs over the lake. No one tracks stink bugs that carefully. So that mystery will remain unsolved. You can see photos at iprnews.org.
IPR's Cheryl Bartz checking out the stink bug situation in Frankfort. It is still a lovely beach, by the way. We'll be right back.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Hey, this is environment reporter Ellie Katz. At IPR, we bring you in-depth, nuanced stories about some of the toughest issues facing our region. But that's not all.
Jellyfish? Really? I didn't know we had jellyfish.
We got jellyfish.
I'll be darned.
You want to see?
Yeah.
Stories of joy, discovery, curiosity, and more from the places we call home. Listen along on air or online at iprnews.org.
Welcome back to The Lowdown. I'm Ed Ronco. In April, a bear turned Grocer's Daughter Chocolate Shop in Empire into its personal pantry. The bear broke into the back door and dragged a 50-pound bag of sugar outside, and then, after literally going to town to do it, metaphorically went to town on the sugar.
I'm so rumbly in my tumbly, a time for something sweet.
It kept coming back for more, which earned it the moniker Sugar Bear, and then a week later, this bear ate 16 chickens at a farm. The Michigan Department of Natural Resources caught and relocated Sugar Bear 60 miles away. Now, if the bear comes back, the DNR could euthanize it. That is what the agency did to a different bear just 3 years ago after it returned from a 90-mile relocation to roam a Meijer store parking lot in Traverse City. Jakob Wheeler is editor and publisher of the Glen Arbor Sun. He's been thinking and writing about how we humans can coexist with bears, and he talked about it with IPR Morning Edition host Tyler Thompson.
How do you see us coexisting with bears?
It's interesting. I mean, I wrote this story in the Glen Arbor Sun in mid-May, Can We Coexist with Bears? Because in reporting on the bear, you know, breaking into the chocolate shop and the DNR finally getting the bear at the chicken farm, I received some pushback and some criticism for some readers and friends who kind of implied that in reporting this in real time, I was kind of feeding this fear that people have of bears that are big mammals, that if you corner their cubs, they can hurt you. The implication that in early reporting was feeding fear and this feeding this kind of relationship of animosity with bears, it inspired a broader essay, a broader question. Are the things we can do to coexist with bears? I quote some poems and some essays that have been written over the years about how we really emulate in our popular culture black bears. They're very smart. They're empathetic. They can live as a family, but they also really thrive on their own. There's an individualistic streak to bears, which we strive for as humans in our culture. I got a book that I found interesting about, you know, what we can learn from bears, how we can learn to coexist with them, called What the Bears Know, How I Found Truth and Magic in America's Most Misunderstood Creatures. It's written by Steve Searles, the bear whisperer of Mammoth Lakes, California. He was tasked years ago by local law enforcement with killing 16, and I'm using air quotes here, 16 problem bears that were showing up in that community. People were feeding them, you know, not just inadvertently through dumpsters that didn't lock or through birdseed, but people were actually feeding them. And they kept showing up, which shouldn't surprise anyone. So Searles was supposed to kill them. Instead, he kind of fell in love with these bears, and he learned how they work, how they operate, you know, their hierarchical conversations between them, how they respond to each other. And he learned of ways that he could scare the bears away, but he also began to teach the townspeople in Mammoth Lakes, California, how they could avoid inviting bears into the community, obviously avoid feeding them, and essentially how humans could coexist with bears. And I think there are some lessons that we can take here in northern Michigan from that.
The last thing you want to do is have to euthanize a bear. What does make that decision? Like, when do you have to make that decision, like, we have to euthanize a bear?
Steve Griffiths from the DNR was unwilling or unable to tell me exactly what would happen to the sugar bear if it returned to Lenakani to Empire. This is the one that was here in April and has since been taken east. But yeah, we have this evidence that the Meyer bear, which was in a populated area, was taken away, returned there, they euthanized it. You know, as a contrast, people will remember the bear that showed up in Traverse City's central neighborhood last year, Mother's Day weekend of 2023, was scared of the humans it encountered, climbed a tree in central neighborhood. People, you know, congregated around it. It was a spectacle. People were taking photos of it. The DNR shows up, and they climbed the tree near the bear. They shot it with a dart to sedate it. It ultimately fell out of the tree onto some mattresses people had put there. The bear was okay. That bear, alive, okay, was taken, again, east 60 or more miles. And then since that bear was sedated, it was tagged, and the DNR was able to track it. It was shot and killed last fall, so several months later, by a hunter in, you know, Michigan's legal and sanctioned bear hunting season. So we know what happened with that bear, but it worked out. It was taken away, and it didn't return. What'll happen with this bear, we don't know.
Jakob Wheeler of the Glen Arbor Sun. You can find links to his stories on our website, iprnews.org. He spoke with Tyler Thompson. All right, let's find out what else made news this week. New data presented at a gathering of housing advocates in Petoskey paint a difficult picture for low and middle-income workers in northern Michigan. People in retail sales, food service, educational support, and other industries cannot afford to live here anymore. Separately, the Ticker reports that the average home price in our region topped $500,000 for the first time. Researchers at the University of Michigan are collaborating with residents of Beaver Island to see if they can use wave energy for electricity. Right now, the 600 or so people who live there year-round get power from an underwater cable and diesel generators. But they've been trying to develop renewable energy for a while. A grant from U of M will help decide where to locate a wave energy converter. This uses the motion of waves in a large body of water to create electrical energy. And this could be a test case for other rural or island communities around the country and in the Great Lakes. An indigenous conservation project aimed at protecting fish, farms, and forests in northern Michigan received $20 million from the federal government. The Record Eagle reports that the award will fund the preservation and restoration of fractured fisheries and wildlife corridors like culverts and spawning areas. The collaboration, formed in 2015, consists of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, the Conservation Resource Alliance, and other partners. That's it for the Up North Lowdown this week. We had contributions from Tyler Thompson, Cheryl Bartz, Michael Livingston, and Izzy Ross. Our music comes from Blue Dot Sessions. Our producer is Max Copeland. I'm Ed Ronco. If you like the Lowdown, we would love it if you'd share it with someone or leave a rating and review on your podcast app. It helps people find us. We leave you this week with the sound of frogs croaking away on a recent spring evening in a pond at the Miller Creek Nature Reserve in Traverse City. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
Hey, Ed.
Hey, Max.
What does a rodeo frog say?
What? Rope it. Did you just think of that, or is that one that you've known?
No, my dad used to tell me these jokes all the time when I was a kid. What does a burglar frog say?
I don't know.
Rob it. What does a barbecue frog say?
What?
Rivet.
Took me a second. I'm there now. I get it.